Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Talking Natural Capital, the podcast from Galbraith. My name is Matt Finlay and I'd like to start by thanking all of you who have listened to episode 1 of the podcast. We're thrilled to get up and running and we're back with a bumper lineup today. I'm joined once again by natural capital and carbon leader Elnar Harris. Elnar, welcome.
Hi, great to be back.
Yeah, it is good to be back and a very warm welcome for our podcast debut to Senior Forester Louise Alexander.
Hiya.
Good to have you on. It's first time we've had three of us on the podcast together, so we'll see how it goes. Louise, we'll start with yourself. Can you just tell us a little bit about the work that you do with Galbraith?
Yeah, so I head up the forestry department in our Inverness office. The forestry department has offices in Inverness, Perth and Penrith. So we cover the length of Scotland and now the north of England. In the north of Scotland and the Inverness office, majority of our work is private estate management, with the major proportion of that aimed at woodland creation. So the last couple of years, we've been responsible for planting over 1,200 hectares of mixed native and productive woodland. So for a team of four in Inverness, it's quite a good coverage that we've managed to make. So
good, and you obviously work a lot with Eleanor as well. So she's been keen to get you on as well.
Yeah, I've come from a forestry background before I came to Galbraith, so for me it was my route into natural capital, and I find the natural capital potential of forestry really exciting. It's a kind of climax habitat, it's productive as well, and the way that we're creating this new landscape in Scotland through forests are really interesting. So hopefully we can start to dig into some of that in this and future podcasts.
Yeah, definitely. Well, today we're obviously, like I said, there's three of us on, so we have a lot of discussions, a lot of really good discussions. First off, Eleanor, what's been happening in the last few weeks?
Well, a major event has been Storm Arwen. It raised all sorts of questions, got everyone very busy. Suddenly everyone was unavailable for contact because they were all out dealing with fallen trees, and both the rural and forestry teams were sorting out trees and sorting out people who've lost their power in buildings. It really got me thinking about, you know, this is an extreme weather event. We know there's going to be more of this sort of thing with climate change. It's affected power, it's affected timber, forestry, it's affected farming, so that's potentially food supply. What lessons can we learn from something happening like that for natural capital? And I think there's all sorts of things.
For the work that we do, obviously, with Galbraith, we cover a vast amount right across the industry, Louise. And how's the effects been felt up in the Inverness office and the kind of work that you've been doing?
So thankfully, can touch wood, Inverness didn't seem to get hit too badly. Everything seemed to be a bit more east and kind of south central belt. Although we don't wish it on anybody else, but yeah, we were quite lucky that we didn't have anything. But our other offices, so Perth and the Penrith office, were both hit quite badly. Some of their estates lost huge tracts of forestry, both productive and native woodland. So yeah, they've been out assessing that and just seeing what the impact of that is going to be in the kind of longer, short and long term for the estates.
My kind of understanding is that for one individual woodland owner, it could be catastrophic. They could have lost their whole woodland, they could have lost ancient trees, or trees could have fallen onto buildings or roads. But actually, from the point of view of the forestry industry and our woodland resource and timber supply and biodiversity, it's not as bad as, you know, maybe the media might make it out, or as we might think it is. Is it 20% of what we would harvest in a normal year?
So in terms of, yeah, it depends on where you're coming from. So like you say, the landowner, if they, you know, they've lost massive strips of woodland and everything else, then it is going to be catastrophic for them. But in terms of the overall industry, short-term impact is there could be a glut in the market of products. So if there's a lot of snap timber and windblow timber, then a lot of that could end up going into the chip market, because you're not going to achieve the kind of log value for them. So there could be a glut in the market on that, but just a very short term impact, I think. So if you're a seller at the moment and you were just about to sell a lot of material, then it could be a negative view for you. But in the longer term, I think it's just the estates kind of have to just take a step back and have a look, if they've got management plans, how they can maybe change, look at the management plan, adjust it slightly to incorporate these areas that have blown, and just how they manage that. I mean, the other thing is there's a lot of discussion just now is that, you know, windblow could be a good thing in the right place for biodiversity, deadwood, etc.
Yeah, well, deadwood is the, you know, one of the greatest biodiversity resources. And one of the things about managing forests is how you can choose how much you leave and where you leave it. And then an event like this happens and suddenly you've got all this unexpected windblow. As foresters are having to redesign their felling plans to accommodate it and think about wind firm edges where they hadn't thought about them before, and maybe some of that will be left, and you're certainly more deadwood around now than there was before. And well, that can only be good.
I mean, the thing is, I mean, although
biodiversity,
in the longer term for leaving the areas to create deadwood, but at the moment, you know, the trees have blown over, they're still viable, there's still viable timber within these, although there could be snapped areas that are snapped, you know, it's kind of a lesser value, but things that are still on the roots that have just blown over has still got quite a high value in them. So that's the thing, it's like taking a step back and having a look and wait and see, you know.
And the timber stays good for quite a long time. That was one thing I learned this week.
So pine does degrade quicker. And especially if it snaps as well, if it's not still on the root, it will degrade quicker. But things like sitka can last 2 or 3 years on the root if it's blown over. So yeah, so there's still value there. So it's not completely catastrophic. I mean, like I say, it just brings forward maybe your management plans or your, you know, the felling proposals that you had.
And it's timber prices are also, I know they've come back a bit, but they're still
still good.
Very
still
high,
very
aren't
good.
They?
Still
so
very good.
If people may suddenly have these fallen trees that they'd never thought of as they'd never intended to sell for timber. It was a shelter belt or it was a woodland that they just enjoyed walking in, and now they've fallen over. But actually they shouldn't, they're now thinking, am I gonna have to pay someone to come and clear this up? Chances are
you could sell it, absolutely. You could put it out to market and sell it to harvesting contractors, absolutely. So, yeah.
So you want to make sure you've got good advice on what it's worth. Yes. You don't get someone.
That's it. Don't just go and clear it up and chop it up into small pieces because you think that's the easiest way to manage it. Right. Because, yeah, absolutely, there will still be value in that timber from a harvesting point of view.
It could be becoming a house or a... Because
absolutely.
That's where we want timber to be going, isn't it? Into construction, that's where it starts locking up carbon.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of this could be.
I mean, the thing just now, Scottish Forestry have come into the press. Obviously, there's a big issue with windblow and felling licences and competent contractors. That's the biggest issue just now. So Scottish Forestry are fast-tracking some windblow felling licences just to try and get them through quicker. But again, it's that thing of getting good advice before you jump into these things and making sure that you look and see. If it's damaged property, if it's fallen on top of a house, it's blocking a road, then absolutely clear that. But anything that's out with those kind of danger areas is just hold off, get some professional advice, look at it, and then submit a felling licence for the windblow.
And there's so many other reasons to consult a professional. I know there's a lot of fear of people going and buying a chainsaw and getting out there and trying to do it themselves and clearing up windblows. Really dangerous, isn't it? You can have...
Absolutely. I mean, that's it. You need to be using competent contractors, And then it's a specialist job, you know. Clearing out windblow, they should have an additional ticket for windblow clearance, most harvesting chainsaw operators, because it is really tricky. There's a lot of different issues that can come up with it.
What I'm starting to maybe see is that the media are starting to focus on stories maybe on the back of COP26 environmental issues. Is this something that is quite new to this for people who don't really understand it, or is it something that's quite common where the media maybe don't necessarily portray a lot of these stories?
Storm Arwen was the kind of, what was it? It was a one in a, I can't remember what they called it, once in a 50 or 100 year occurrence. So this kind of catastrophic windblow doesn't happen that often. I'm trying to think back to the last time we had a major windblow incident like this. I remember the one in 86 or something like that down south. That was the big storms, wasn't it? And but in my short forestry lifetime, this is the biggest
one.
Yeah, very very young. This is the biggest one that we've had, and it does. I think speaking to people in the industry, it's not a normal occurrence. This isn't a normal occurrence. It may end up starting to be now with climate change. In terms of the public interest, it's always going to go to, you know, the impacts on the general public, you know, so the power outages and everything else. So there hasn't been an awful lot of talk about the damage to trees.
Yeah, I felt it's been really interesting following social media chat, and you've got the how much do people understand this 1 in 100 year storm? You know, what we know in the past, it's been 1 in 100 years. In the future, well, we don't actually know what it's going to be. Is it going to be 1 in 50 years? Is it going to be every year? What's it going to be? So that throws up all sorts of climate resilience questions.
Near where I'm from in the northeast, just outside Ellen, and it's Haddo House. They actually were on the news this week after Storm Arwen devastated the National Trust site, and 100,000 trees have been destroyed there. Now, for me coming in from the outside, that sounds like quite a lot. And Louise, is this something that is quite common again, or is this something that is even by this industry standards quite an extreme event?
Rightly or wrongly, there's different values attributed to these different kinds of woodlands. You know, it's for productive woodland, I mean, that's 100,000 trees is a massive loss for investments and for the people that have been growing it and everything else. But again, but the general public don't, that's not such an easy thing to relate to. Whereas if you see big swathes of an ancient woodland, big old oak trees, which we've seen toppled, you know, people take ownership of these trees, and they you know, they have a feeling for these trees, and they lose that, you know, they really take, that does hit home. So there's two different kind of looks at that, you know, whether what kind of woodland it is. But yeah, 100,000 trees is a lot of trees to be losing.
It's a lot, and it's a lot. It really messes up if you've got a planned forest and you're a big forest that's being managed for involving timber, but maybe biodiversity and maybe recreation as well. There'll be a plan in place, won't there, that says we're going to fell this bit in this year, and then this bit 3 years later, and then the next bit will be, and all those have gone out the window. There's going to be a lot of work replanning.
I mean, we're talking as if the trees that are blown over were already at harvestable age. You know, if they're younger, you know, then you've lost that value in the trees, you know, so they may not, in terms of what's actually harvestable from them, it could be minimal. So that's another loss to think of. But then you've also got the issue of having to go in and replant all of this and get it established again. I mean, trees, I mean, everything takes a long time in forestry. So, you know, you've lost over 60, 80 years worth of growth in a tree. So yeah, so you're starting from scratch again. But again, it gives you that chance to kind of step back and say, you know, some of these plantations may, or woodlands may be something that you weren't really that keen on. You know, we're looking to maybe remanage the area and have a think about it. So it would maybe give you opportunities to come back in and have another think about what you want to do with it. So,
do you think, is there a risk that something like Arwen, people will think twice about planting trees and think, oh, actually, is it a risky investment? Or if I was trying to do a carbon woodland, so will it blow down, or am I creating a public liability? Mm-hmm. You know, is that a danger? And how would we counter it?
I'm not going to make a general sweeping assumption about every woodland that's blown over, because that would just get me into trouble. But a lot of the older kind of woodlands, a lot of the older plantations and other things like that, were established using older techniques. Whereas now, woodlands that are being established are being better designed for resilience. So not just species choice, but the ground preparation that's done, the right trees in the right place, actually planting it on ground that's suitable. So a lot of plantations that we're managing now that are 60, 70 years old, a lot of them were planted on deep peat, you know, and they were ploughed. And in terms of the stability of these plantations and whether, you know, the ongoing kind of silvicultural management of these areas, including thinnings, you know, going through and doing thinnings, would make the woodland more resilient to future windthrow damage. So yeah, but that's a general assumption of all these woodlands that blew over, and I'm not going to say that.
No, but I think this, what, you know, how you could design more wind resilient forests is going to become ever more important, and maybe possibly fire resilient forests in future.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, that's when we're putting forward designs for woodland creation areas, it's the questions we're getting asked. It's all about the climate resilience. What we're looking at going forward, we can't just look at today as a snapshot, and I can't just say, well, this grew here previously, so, you know, it should work, because that's not the way it's going. You can see through all the climate models that it isn't going to be like that. You're going to be wetter or drier, you know, it's all changing. So we have to think of that, and areas that were planted previously should probably have never been planted in some areas, so we're having to create a lot more open ground through it.
Are there ways of like designing edges of forests that create a, you know, kind of buffer against the wind, or, you know, breaking up forests with gaps in between so they don't all knock each other over?
Yeah, well, I think it's that, but then also it's the management of the woodlands. A lot of older plantations haven't been managed previously, there was not the value in the timber, in the younger timber. So people weren't thinning the woodlands because what they were thinning out in the first kind of first, second, third thinnings wasn't creating a value to them. So it didn't make sense financially to do it. Whereas now, improved machinery and everything else that we've got and a better value, better market, we can see there is a financial reward for doing the thinnings. So ongoing management of the woodlands is one of the most important things. You can't just shut the gate and kind of hope when you come back in 50, 60 years' time they're going to have a decent crop to come back to. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I think we could do a whole podcast on biomass, and I hope we will.
Yeah.
But that relationship between woodland management and thinnings and wood fuel biomass has been quite, you know, I've seen it transform forests in Scotland because these woods that weren't thinned and should have been are now, you know, and biomass isn't the only thing you can use thinnings for, but it's an important
huge market for us,
part of the mix. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a case that forests are being chopped down and burnt. It's a case that forests are being managed so as to grow the high quality timber by having that market for the thinnings at the earlier stage, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's sustainable because otherwise these trees would die away or, you know, blow over. There'd be no value to them. Whereas we can go in and open them up and create a market for this.
Species choice you kind of mentioned, and conifers seem to have fared worse than broadleaves, and I've various people have noticed, including me, that larch has fared better than other conifers. So is it actually to do with being conifers? Is it because the storm was in the winter and all those trees didn't have leaves and deciduous trees?
I mean,
like larch,
that's the main thing we do say, you know, your broadleaves are going to fare better than larch because they don't have that sail effect in the wind, you know, whereas in the conifers will. I mean, it's not a huge sail effect like a full leaf, a broadleaf and full leaf, but there is that major main kind of thought behind that.
Are there choices that if you were if you are growing timber, are there any choices at the moment for doing that though? Because are there broadleaf options for timber?
Well, there is the productive broadleaf model that you can do to woodland creation. So it's quite restrictive in terms of the kind of ground that you can grow it on. There's only a few species that you can actually use. So oak is one of the main ones, silver birch, wild cherry. So there are sycamore, it's another one, which is controversial. But yeah, so you can plant them through the productive broadleaf model. It's quite an intensive management model, but there is an option there. But I think it's more driven by the markets. There isn't a huge market in Scotland anyway for productive broadleafs. So whether that increases over the years, I mean, at the majority.
There might be in 30 years.
Yeah,
time
absolutely.
If you plant
that's it.
Now,
it's looking at the future forecasting for it. So, yeah, so is that. I think we're quite restricted in terms of the timber markets, and it's something that, you know, there's discussions ongoing with a lot of the timber, the mills, as to what they're geared up to actually accept through the mills. It's quite a narrow range.
Well, but that's my understanding is that a lot of Sitka spruce is planted because it was cheap and easy and grew in all these places that we don't plant trees anymore, and now it's all grown, and so the mills saw that species coming and they went, right, we'll gear ourselves up to process all this material that's coming. Mm-hmm. And now we've got a processing sector that is set up for Sitka spruce. That's going to stay probably the most important component of our forests for a long time because it is so adaptable and good quality timber and grows so well. But but I don't see any reason why if the material's there, then someone will find a use for it.
Absolutely.
If it can be grown to a quality that can be used for construction and things, then I hope that it'd be.
I think again, it's future forecasting for these things, but it's ensuring the management is followed through with. That's what's been the problem in the past, is the silvicultural management. So the productive broadleaf model, it is quite intensive management. So you're having to go in and do some pruning and everything else, which as an industry in Scotland, it's not something that we kind of go, we're going out to prune our broadleaves today, because it's not something we've been doing in the past. Like, we never did thinnings, but we've started doing thinnings. So maybe it's something coming on. I don't know the statistics for how much of the productive broadleaf model's actually been used. It'd be interesting to find out. We've used it on a few sites on the better ground, but again, it's kind of minimal compared to the other models that we're using through the woodland creation.
So management of forests going forward is going to be a lot about get the right species choice, and that's only getting harder with new diseases that seem to keep appearing in our forests.
So the new Phytophthora pluviatis, which was not that long ago discovered in Cornwall, on Western Hemlock and Douglas fir and radiata pine, they've now discovered a site in Loch Carron, some Western Hemlock that's showing signs of it. So that's quite an issue with us up in the north. I've spoken to Scottish Forestry, have spoken to us, and they're concerned that it may jump into Scots pine. So at the moment they're trying to work out how they manage this up here. And if it's if all of a sudden it's jumped from Cornwall to Loch Carron, then it kind of indicates that it's been here for quite a long time and we're only just really aware of any of the symptoms that we're seeing. So it could be quite an issue. But
Yeah, and that if it's in Scots pine, then that could be catastrophic not just for timber, but for Scotland's habitat.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, you were talking about the importance of management, and it strikes me that it's in these undermanaged forests that diseases like that will appear and nobody will notice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But it's also talking about forests for multiple benefits, and forests should be able to provide timber and biodiversity and your recreation that is clearly so important and so hard to put a figure on. But that's why people buy woodlands, shelter and integrating with livestock and all these things, carbon capture, evidently. But you need that design and that management of the woodland. It won't just happen by itself. Nature will do the work, but we need the kind of people creating the conditions for the trees to grow in the ways that we want them to achieve what we need. And that's where, coming back to natural capital, that's what I find really interesting, is how we start to understand and balance these and create that value, not just for the forests, but for the management that is required to deliver them and to create them and nurture them over these long timescales.
Well, that's just about all we've got time for. Ladies, it's been fantastic listening to you speak today. Really, really good insight into the work that you're obviously both doing, especially given in the last few weeks how difficult it has been for a lot of people, those affected by Storm Arwen, as Forestry is, and as kind of hit the headlines, I suppose, really, isn't it? So, Louise, I'm sure you've passed the test. Eleanor might beg to differ, but I'm sure you'll be welcome back on the show in the near future.
Frequent visitor, I hope.
Louise, just finally, thank you for joining us today. Eleanor, of course, it's always a pleasure. It's only the second episode, but we're up and running now, as we said earlier.
Yeah, I feel at home already.
good, exactly. Well, you are from home today as well, so yes. There you go then. It's recorded on Zoom from home. So
Harris Towers.
Exactly. It's early days for us here at Talking Natural Capital, but we are, of course, looking forward to producing more shows in the coming weeks, so keep your eyes peeled. A reminder, you can find us across social media. We're on Facebook and LinkedIn, and you can catch us on Twitter at Galbraith_group and Instagram at Galbraith Group. Eleanor, just a little plug for yourself, you're on the social media too.
I'm generally Eleanor M. Harris on all those formats, so yep, come and follow me. Louise is there as well, I should say.
Louise is there.
Well, we've got a Galbraith Forestry Twitter page, so yeah, you can follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll be able to get the podcast, of course, on there and across all our channels. And thank you for listening again. And thank you again to Eleanor and Louise. And we'll see you all down the road.
Thank you.